Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif have wrapped up 3 days of nuclear talks in Switzerland on Wednesday, with officials from both sides saying progress was made. The Iranian Foreign Minister made comments to reporters.
We have, but a lot of work has remained.
A senior U.S. State Department official said intense discussions yielded some progress, but there remain challenges to reach a framework deal with a proposed deadline at the end of the month. World powers are seeking a deal that would limit Iran's uranium enrichment levels as part of a plan to keep Tehran from developing nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Iran is seeking an agreement that gives it relief from international sanctions. Mexican security forces say they have captured the leader of the violent Zetas drug cartel. Federal officials say Omar Treviño Morales, who is also known by the alias of Zeta 42, was arrested Wednesday in a suburb of Monterrey in northeastern Mexico. Treviño Morales took over leadership of the gang after his brother was arrested in 2013. The Zetas have been blamed for many of the bloodiest atrocities carried out by Mexican gangs. That's Russian President Vladimir Putin. He acknowledged Wednesday that the murder of the opposition leader Boris Nemtsov was politically motivated, while Moscow said it has identified suspects in the case. President Putin told a televised meeting of the Interior Ministry that Russia should be freed of high-profile crimes, including those with a political motive. Nemtsov was an outspoken critic of Moscow, who was shot in the back 4 times last week, steps from the Kremlin. VOA News. Dozens of miners are missing and feared dead after an explosion Wednesday at a coal mine in the rebel-held part of eastern Ukraine. Rebel authorities in the separatist stronghold of Donetsk says the explosion was not caused by shelling that is hit frequently in the area. A rescue operation is ongoing at the coal mine in Donetsk. However, rescue crews say they're being hampered by pro-Russian separatists in the city. Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, however, blames Moscow.
That is why I publicly address the President of the Russian Federation to give instructions to these bastards to allow our mine rescue brigades to save the lives of miners.
Local authorities said over 200 workers were in the mine at the time of the explosion. However, the cause of that explosion is not clear. Lesotho's leading opposition party has formed a coalition government after a snap election gave no group an outright majority. The Democratic Congress finished a close second in Saturday's election with 37 seats. That's 3 seats behind the Prime Minister's All Basotho Convention. Friday, in an interview with the VOA, there were confirmed plans for a coalition government with Mosili at the head. Results were released on Wednesday with 100% of the vote counted. South Sudan's warring sides are criticizing Tuesday's UN resolution that paves the way for sanctions should the sides fail to reach a comprehensive peace deal by a Thursday deadline. Martha Vanderwolf reports.
The UN Security Council moved Tuesday to make good on threats of sanctions unless the sides reach a detailed power-sharing agreement by the March 5th deadline. South Sudan opposition delegation member Goy Jo Jul says the United Nations acted prematurely.
The resolution is disturbing at this point because we are still negotiating and we have not reached conclusion through the peace process.
If imposed, the sanctions would freeze assets and travel for anyone seen as obstructing the peace process of committing human rights abuses. An arms embargo may follow if the two sides do not abide by the peace deal. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Human Rights Watch is urging Iraqi forces and pro-government fighters to protect civilians. The call comes as they press an offensive against the Islamic State group to reclaim the strategic city of Tikrit. The group said Wednesday that it has documented multiple instances of those forces committing abuses after retaking other towns in Iraq. The U.S. Justice Department will release a report Wednesday accusing the police department in Ferguson, Missouri, of routinely violating the constitutional rights of its black citizens. The report is a result of a 6-month investigation. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
South Sudan's warring sides are criticizing Tuesday's UN resolution that paves the way for sanctions should the sides fail to reach a comprehensive peace deal by a Thursday deadline.
That's Martha van der Wolf covering the last-ditch talks in Addis Ababa. Details coming up. Also in the news, the shooting death of a top opposition allied Mozambican lawyer has caused shockwaves and has raised many questions about Mozambique's future. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Italy's Coast Guard says it rescued more than 900 migrants aboard five motorized dinghies and two larger vessels on the Mediterranean Sea yesterday. 10 passengers died when their raft capsized shortly before rescue 50 miles off the coast of Libya. Two cargo ships aided in the rescue when the Tunisian Navy picked up more than 80 migrants near the Tunisian island of Djerba. Officials say the migrants claim to be from Syria, Palestine, Libya, Tunisia, and from sub-Saharan African countries. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 200,000 migrants crossed the Mediterranean by boat last year. 3,500 died in the attempt. South Sudan's warring sides are criticizing yesterday's UN resolution that paves the way for sanctions should the sides fail to reach a comprehensive peace deal by Thursday deadline. Martha van der Wolf is covering the last-ditch talks in Addis Ababa aimed at ending 15 months of violence in the world's youngest country.
After months of frustration with South Sudan's government and rebels, the UN Security Council moved Tuesday to make good on threats of sanctions unless the sides reach a detailed power-sharing agreement by the March 5th deadline. The UN resolution came as South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar continued to meet behind closed doors here in Addis Ababa. South Sudan opposition delegation member Goy Jo Jul says the United Nations acted prematurely.
You know, as much as the resolution is disturbing at this point, because we are still negotiating and we have not reached a conclusion to the peace process, but we also welcome the resolution on those people who are obstructing peace.
If imposed, the sanctions would freeze assets and travel for anyone seen as obstructing the peace process of committing human rights abuses. An arms embargo may follow if the two sides do not abide by the peace deal. The 15-month conflict, caused by a political split between Mr. Kiir and his former deputy Machar, has killed more than 10,000 people and displaced 1.5 million. More than a year of talks has failed to produce a concrete peace deal and all ceasefires have been quickly broken. There is no public indication of progress in this round of negotiations. Kiir and Machar spoke to each other for about 5 hours on Tuesday and they continued Wednesday morning. Jo Jul says the two parties are still far apart on the issue of security.
We believe that issues of security needs a lot of trust building. And therefore, we are requesting for more time for the integration of the forces. It should not happen as immediate as the government is demanding.
South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Barnaba Mario Benjamin, also sees the threatened sanctions as counterproductive.
The decision of sanctions actually blocks the peace process. It has also brought into question the agreed partnership between the United Nations and the African Union. They should have waited to see the decision of IGAD, to see the decision of African Union before they take this decision.
Benjamin expresses disappointment in the leading role the United States played in passing the UN resolution. Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn told the two sides on Tuesday that the region and the international community will not stand by and watch a humanitarian and political crisis in South Sudan continue. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Election results in Lesotho show no outright winner in Saturday's elections, making a coalition government likely. Prime Minister Thomas Tabenz, also the All Bosotho Convention, won 40 seats, followed closely by the Democratic Congress with 37. A supermajority of 61 seats was needed for an outright win. Results were released with 100% of the votes counted, but the Electoral Commission has yet to make an official announcement. Saturday's election was held 2 years earlier than scheduled. It followed an attempted coup in August that forced Prime Minister Tabenz to temporarily flee the country. The shooting death of a top opposition-allied Mozambican lawyer has analysts concerned that this nation's violent past has come back to haunt it. Gilles Sistak was a prominent lawyer and professor who had drawn criticism from government media in recent weeks for supporting an opposition initiative to decentralize power in the resource-rich nation. Friends say his death has caused shockwaves and has raised many questions about Mozambique's future. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Police and media reports say lawyer and scholar Gilles Sistak was at a popular restaurant on a main boulevard in central Maputo when he was shot several times by unidentified assailants in a passing car on Tuesday morning. He later died of his wounds at Maputo's central hospital. Sistak, 53, was born in France, but had lived in the Southern African nation since 1993 and had taken Mozambican citizenship. He was a law professor at Maputo's prestigious Eduardo Mondlane University. More recently, he had publicly supported a movement by opposition party RENAMO for greater autonomy in the nation's north and center. Both RENAMO and the ruling Frelimo party have condemned the shooting. British journalist Paul Fauvet is a longtime resident of Mozambique. He was among a crowd that he estimated to number in the several hundreds who visited the crime scene on Tuesday night to lay candles and flowers. He spoke to VOA News via Skype.
I mean, this has sent a shockwave through Maputo society, particularly, of course, through the academic communities where he started work.
Fauvet was a close friend of a prominent Mozambican journalist, Carlos Cardoso, who was killed under similar circumstances in 2000 while investigating a major corruption case. Several suspects in Cardoso's murder said former President Joaquim Chissano's son paid for the killing. Top journalist and commentator Fernando Lima says Sistak had been recently vilified in social media and in the state-run press for saying that RENAMO's autonomy bid could be justified under the Constitution. That, he told VOA, points to a clear and unsettling motive.
I'm convinced that the way it was done, it was clearly an assassination. And Mr. Sistak is known to be a very, very private person, very concentrated on his academic research, on his teaching at university. So one cannot argue that it could be something of a domestic issue, another crime issue, because here very often people are killed under business arguments, especially on the drug war. It's not known any kind of controversial connection to the underworld of crime, and Mr. Sistak is clearly the fact that he stand up for the decentralization of the country.
Mozambique was torn apart by a lengthy, brutal civil war that ended in 1992. Since then, the discovery of massive gas reserves has bolstered its image as an investment destination. Mozambique's largely peaceful October elections were seen as a step forward on its path towards becoming an African energy giant. Lima says he is concerned that the event could be a blow to Mozambique's image as an up-and-coming democracy, eager to shed its violent past and draw in much-needed investment.
It's very sad because 15 years ago, the killing of journalist Carlos Cardoso provoked big, big damage on the image of our country in our institutions. And we thought that the country's institutions, the government, the ruling party, have learned a lesson so that these kind of things would never happen again. So here we are again with an assassination with political motivations. And this is very, very bad for the image of this country.
And he said Sistak's death leaves a void in the nation's legal system.
In a country with such lack of resources, I think all Mozambicans should be proud of such an intellectual as Jules Sistak. And a very, very important thing, this country does not have many judges and lawyers, but I can say for sure that the majority of lawyers and judges and the prosecutors in this country have been trained by Professor Jules Sistak.
It is a loss, he said, that will hurt more than one family, one university, one political party. It could, he said, wound an entire nation that is struggling to heal its own deep scars. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. South Sudan's warring sides are criticizing yesterday's UN resolution that paves the way for sanctions should the sides fail to reach a comprehensive peace deal. And the shooting death of a top opposition allied Mozambican lawyer has caused shockwaves and has raised many questions about Mozambique's future. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. UN humanitarian officials report the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, launched nearly 200 attacks since January of last year in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic. The LRA is blamed for at least 36 deaths in that period and more than 550 abductions. While the group killed fewer people than in 2013, abductions rose by over 60%. The UN says about 27,000 people remain displaced in areas where the LRA is active in the DRC and CAR. A new study warns that in Africa, illness causing fevers are often misdiagnosed as malaria. For example, the study finds that dengue fever is circulating in urban areas of Ghana, but is mistaken for malaria. The findings could trigger a reevaluation of anti-malaria efforts. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Dengue fever is caused by a virus transmitted through a mosquito bite. It's a flu-like illness that has a fatality rate of about 5%. The World Health Organization says there's no specific treatment, but early detection and proper medical care can sharply reduce the risk of death. While the death rate may be low, dengue has hindered development in parts of the world. The study's lead investigator, Justin Stoller, has studied dengue fever and malaria for many years in Latin America. But while doing research in Ghana, he wondered whether dengue and other febrile diseases ever had been considered a big problem.
I had always noticed that the urban ecology, the types of breeding environments that certain mosquitoes like, all existed in West Africa, and yet these diseases were generally off physicians' radar. And many years ago, I sat in a symposium with Ghana Medical Society, and they were talking about the high malaria rates. And I asked, I said, have you looked at other viral fevers, other types of diseases that are circulating everywhere else in the tropics? And I was roundly shook off. And I thought to myself, well, someone needs to look into this stuff.
Stoller is assistant professor of geography at the University of Miami College of Arts and Sciences. He says the study is the first to show that dengue and other fever-causing diseases are circulating in Ghana. In fact, he says many diseases with classic fever and headache symptoms that are circulating are being misdiagnosed on a massive scale.
The best data that we have is from Accra, Ghana's capital, and we see there roughly 40 to 45% of all outpatient visits. Anyone presenting at a hospital, a healthcare facility, for any reason, are walking out of there with a presumptive malaria diagnosis, which is a staggering number in and of itself. Now, what we're just starting to learn in the last few years is that when you actually do confirmatory blood tests and you look at who really has malaria, typically it's less than 10% of that group who's presumed to have malaria.
So, if those figures are correct, what diseases could the rest actually have?
Well, we started with dengue because it's widespread across the tropics. It's recognized. It's something many people have heard of. But in reality, it's probably just a small piece of the pie. There are bacterial infections, other viral fevers, viral infections, things like influenza, fungal diseases, other parasitic infections, really a whole menu of things that people are dealing with on a regular basis.
Many of the diseases are water-related, and infections can increase during the rainy season or floods. And it's not just malaria mosquitoes that breed in these conditions.
So when you see spikes in people rushing to the hospitals and the clinics after the rainy season, again, this is part of the reason why we have this institutionalized view that after the rainy season, you see spikes in fevers, therefore it is all malaria. But it's actually all these other diseases that have very similar links and ecologies.
Stoller says the findings have the potential to cause donors to rethink their anti-malaria strategies. The Rollback Malaria Campaign's Global Action Plan estimates nearly $6 billion a year is spent to fight malaria.
At least in parts of rapidly urbanizing Africa, maybe malaria is not their biggest problem. I don't mean to undermine the importance of fighting malaria in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world in general, but malaria has traditionally been a rural disease, and that's probably still where most of the burden exists. But really, all the action is in urban places, and there are a lot of other things that people are dealing with there.
Since dengue is spread by mosquitoes, would anti-malarial bed nets help to reduce infections?
Well, that's what's interesting. There's some evidence that in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa that the Aedes mosquitoes that spread dengue fever, also mosquitoes that are responsible for spreading chikungunya and yellow fever, by the way, these mosquitoes tend to be active at dawn and dusk. And so using mosquito nets, you may get a little bit of protection in the early morning hours. But the reality is that these mosquitoes do bite throughout the day and that traditional interventions like bed nets are not going to be effective in getting the vast reductions in morbidity and mortality that we see with malaria control.
Stoller says the findings should be presented to various medical societies for consideration. He also says healthcare workers should be trained to look for other lesser-known infections. The University of Miami associate professor says the findings can also play a role in the writing of the Sustainable Development Goals. They'll replace the Millennium Development Goals at the end of this year. The study appears in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And Indian authorities have blocked the screening of a BBC documentary amid a massive outrage over a controversial interview with one of the rapists in the brutal gang rape that shook the country 2 years ago. But as Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, some say the solutions does not lie in banning the film, but in changing a social mindset that devalues women.
Saying that women who go out at night have only themselves to blame, Mukesh Singh, one of the six men who raped a 23-year-old physiotherapy student in December 2012, told a BBC filmmaker that a girl is far more responsible for rape than a man. Singh is in New Delhi's Tihar jail as he appeals his death sentence for the rape of Jyoti Singh on a bus she boarded after watching a film at night. Showing no remorse, he told filmmaker Leslie Udwin that had Jyoti Singh not resisted the rape, they would not have inflicted the savage beating that led to her death. She should have been silent and allowed the rape, he said. The hour-long documentary, India's Daughter, in which the interview is being featured, is scheduled for broadcast by BBC 4 on March 8th. An Indian TV channel was also to telecast the film. But as massive outrage erupted over Singh's comments, police moved swiftly to block his interview, saying it could create an atmosphere of fear and tension with the possibility of public outcry. Television channels have been advised not to broadcast the film. Home Minister Rajnath Singh accused the filmmakers of violating the conditions under which permission was given for the interview.
It was noticed that the documentary film depicts the comments of the convict which are highly derogatory and are an affront to the dignity of women.
For once, prominent women activists were on the same page as the government, decrying the film for what they said amounted to giving a platform to a rapist and a murderer. Ranjana Kumari, who heads the Center for Social Research in New Delhi, said Mukesh Singh's response was typical of widespread attitudes among men.
I don't think that any discovery has been made by what he has revealed. This is what the rapist mindset is all about. I mean, if at all any interview was to be done, it should have been for a psychiatrist's purposes or for a sociologist to analyze, to really, bring this kind of interview out and then to play it. And sell it. I think this is totally unacceptable. It is really a violation of dignity of women.
The outrage is not just over the rapist's comments. Angry questions are also being raised over why a foreign filmmaker was granted permission to interview Singh and other rapists in jail. Filmmaker Udvin defended the film at a special screening of the movie held in New Delhi on Tuesday before it was banned. Udvin, herself a sexual assault victim, says she had the necessary approvals and is saddened by the move to ban it. The movie, which reconstructs the events of the night of the gang rape, also carries interviews with the girl's parents, lawyers and the doctor. Udvin says she was shocked by the way Mukesh Kumar views women.
And that is what is extremely shocking. Not what he did, but what he thinks that led him to do what he did. And it's not just he who thinks that. It's a societal problem. No regret for 1 second out of 16 hours. No regret. In fact, the opposite. Mukesh's attitude is, why are they making a fuss about us? Everybody's doing it.
Amid the heat and dust raised over the interview, some voices pointed out that one of the central issues the film highlights is being lost. The mindset of a society that devalues women. A well-known filmmaker, Javed Akhtar, questioned the furor over the documentary and the anger over the rapist's comments that women invite trouble if they roam around at night. He says he's very glad that the documentary has been made so that millions of Indian men can understand that they also think the same way as the rapist does. He says, if these men disliked what Mukesh Singh said, they should change their mindsets. Lawmaker Anu Aga, who is also a businesswoman and a social worker, echoed similar sentiments.
Suggesting death penalty, banning this movie is not the answer. We have to confront the issue that men in India do not respect women. And any time there is a rape, blame is put on the woman that she was indecently dressed, she provoked the men. It is not just the man in the prison's views, it's the views of many men in India. Let's be aware of it and let's not pretend that all is well.
And as the infamous gang rape once again comes center stage, others, including the parents of the gang rape victim, are asking agonized questions about why the case has not yet drawn to a conclusion, though over 2 years have passed since the incident. While a fast-track court delivered the verdict in what is a record for India, 9 months, the appeal of the convicted men is hanging in the Supreme Court. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello. I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan's warring sides are criticizing yesterday's UN resolution that paves the way for sanctions should the sides fail to reach a comprehensive peace deal. And the shooting death of a top opposition allied Mozambican lawyer has caused shockwaves and has raised many questions about Mozambique's future. Coming up, music from Burundi. And in our feature segment, UN aid agencies are in a desperate attempt to stave off a potentially large-scale cholera epidemic in Malawi. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with African club football.
Yehias, joining us once again on The Voice of America is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's kick off with African club football. The draws for the first round proper in both the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup competitions have now been held. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. How does that look?
Sunny, we've got Zesco United of Zambia up against Kaloum of Guinea. Now, Kaloum are a surprise participant. Most people, myself included, would have expected Seaway Sport from Ivory Coast to face Zesco. But Kaloum won 2-1 in Abidjan, and then in neutral Mali, because of the Ebola epidemic, Kaloum drew 1-1. However, there are some factors to consider that makes this perhaps not quite as big a shock as some people believe. Seaway, after losing the final of the 2014 CAF Confederation Cup to Al Ahly of Egypt on the away goal rule, they lost three of their star players, the goalkeeper, and two of their midfielders, Kouame and Asale. And this has been reflected, Sonny, in their form at home in the domestic league, where they're second from bottom of the table. We've then got USM Alger of Algeria against Bikini of Senegal. Al Hilal, regular competitors in the Champions League, will face Big Bullets of Malawi. Cotton Spore of Cameroon will face Sanga Balende of DR Congo. Cosmos Bafia, after a good comeback against the Ugandans KCCA, they'll be up against one of the giants of African football, Esperance of Tunisia. El Marak of Sudan, the comeback kings, they'll be up against Cabascor of Angola. Now, Marak lost 2-0 away to Azam in Tanzania in the first leg, but then Azam melted in the heat of Omdurman. It was 2 minutes into stoppage time when the Kenyan Alan Wanga scored the decisive third goal for the Sudanese club. Samassi Sokoti of Togo will face CS Sfaxien of Tunisia. Ulma of Algeria will play Ashanti Kotoko of Ghana, twice winners of this competition, but some time ago. And then a big one for all our Nigerian listeners, Enyimba of Nigeria against Smuha of Egypt. Now, Enyimba basically did their work at home against Buffaloes of Benin, building a 3-goal lead. But nevertheless, a good away performance by the People's Elephant. They went to Cotonou and won the return match by 1-0. You think of Egypt, you think of the Champions League, and you think of Atli and Zamalek. But this time, while Atli have made it again, Zamalek were pipped for second place by Smuha. They're a club from Alexandria, and they beat Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya on penalties after both sides had won 1-0 at home. It's also great, Sonny, to see a Kenyan club among the last 32. They are Gor Mahia, and they will play AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville. The military club from Rwanda, APR, they're up against Al Ahly of Egypt. Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco will play Kano Pillar.
Yeah, so he's going to announce that today?
Now, Tetouan mirrored the performance of Morocco. They were also 2 goals behind after their first leg against CO Bamako of Mali. But they came back strongly, won 3-0 at home, and qualified for the last 32. Real Banjul of Gambia, or Barak Young Controllers of Liberia, their second leg, Sonny, is coming up this weekend, and the winners of that have got a very appetizing tie. They will face the defending champions, Entente Setif of Algeria. Then we've got a match that could well be a final in itself. You've got Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa against Raja Casablanca of Morocco, two of the real giants of African football. I think it's a shame that these two clubs have to meet at the last 32 stage. And interestingly, because they're not getting the best of crowds in Soweto, Chiefs are considering moving their first leg to Durban. It's an Indian Ocean city where they get much bigger crowds. I could see 50,000 wanting to watch this game. This is a real clash of giants. And South African clubs have not been blessed by good draws at all, because the other competitors from the country, Mamelodi Sundowns, they're going to be up against TP Mazembe from DR Congo, four times African champions. And Mazembe are still, I think, seeding at their qualifying loss a couple of seasons ago to Orlando Pirates of South Africa. So they'll have revenge very much on their menu. And then the last match, Mangospor of Gabon against Stade Malien of Mali. The first leg, Sonny, are on March 13, 14 and 15. And the second leg's on April 3, 4 and 5. And certainly a lot of tasty matches coming up with, I think, Kaiser Chiefs against Raja Casablanca topping the menu.
Some tasty matches indeed, David. How about the Confederation Cup? How is that tournament shaping up?
Right, Sonny, we're also at the last 32 stage, and it's Ons Creatures of Mali against Sahel of Niger, Asik Mimosas of Ivory Coast against Al Ittihad of Libya, Djeliba of Mali against Petrojet of Egypt, Hearts of Oak of Ghana against Ngor of Senegal, Horoya of Guinea against Clef of Algeria, Club Africain of Tunisia against Dolphins of Nigeria. That's going to be a tough one for Dolphins, Sonny. They scraped through. They beat a team whose name translated means the Vegetarian Lions of Equatorial Guinea, certainly one of the more interesting club titles I've come across in Africa in recent years. Dolphins lost 1-0 away. They won 1-0 at home, and then they scraped through on penalties. And I feel, Sonny, they're going to have to up their performance if they want to get the better of Club Africain. The other Nigerian competitors, Wari Wolves, they were convincing winners over Bobo of Burkina Faso. And I feel they can advance even further. Their next opponents will be Dedabit of Ethiopia. Al Ahly Shendi of Sudan will play Etanchieti of DR Congo. Zamalek of Egypt, down to the Confederations Cup this year, they'll play Rayon Sport of Rwanda. FUS Rabat of Morocco will play Port of Togo. Munana of Gabon up against Power Dynamos of Zambia. Now, Power Dynamos had a good win. They were up against Al Khartoum of Sudan. They won 2-0 in Kitwe for a 2-1 aggregate victory. And that unfortunately means the end of interest in this competition for Kwesi Appiah. He's the 2014 Ghana World Cup coach, and he was hoping to resurrect his career at club level with Khartoum. Well, they're out of Africa now, so he's going to have to tackle those two big boys of Sudanese football, Al Hilal and El Merak, for the championship title there. Orlando Pirates of South Africa, they will play the team they call the Tax Collectors, Revenue Authority, from Uganda. Young Africans of Tanzania, another East African challenger, they'll be up against Platinum from Zimbabwe. Etoile Sahel of Tunisia face Benfica Luanda of Angola. Famous name that, of course, Benfica. One of the giants in previous years of European football. Royal Leopards of Swaziland will face Petro Atletico of Angola. And this, Sonny, is definitely the most unlikeliest of ties, because Royal Leopards were drawn against Wits of South Africa. Now, when you pair a South African and Swazi team, there inevitably is only one result, and that's going to be a South African victory. And the big question is, by how many goals? And Wits, having built a 3-0 first leg lead, it was assumed that they would cruise through to the last 32. But the Leopards, a police team from Swaziland, had other ideas. They led 1-0 at halftime. They were 3-up by the 70th minute. And they then won the penalty shootout. So a big, big high five to everybody there in Swaziland, and especially to the players, the coaches, and the officials of Royal Leopards. A fantastic performance by them. And the last fixture, Sonny, is V Club of DR Congo, runners-up, remember, in the 2014 Champions League. They will be up against Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique. And the dates are similar to the Champions League. First legs, March 13, 14, and 15. Second legs, April 3, 4, and 5.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. VOA! I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out my Facebook page today, Wednesday, you'll see a new profile photo of yours truly taken by my trusty producer this evening, Bill Werkinger. Bill's photo also includes David Vandy, the host of our African Beat radio show, as well as Alex Villarreal, the co-host of our On Assignment TV show. The Africa Open Golf Tournament tees off on Thursday near Port Alfred on the Eastern Cape of South Africa. Reporter Mark Tompkins has this preview for us from the East London Golf Club.
With 2014 champion Thomas Akin not here to defend his title this week, the stage is set in South Africa for what should be a fascinating 4 days of golf at the East London Golf Club that will be played against the stunning backdrop of the Indian Ocean. All six previous Africa Opens on this course have been won by South Africans, but only Darren Fichard, who triumphed here 2 years ago, is here this week. Jaco van Zyl finished tied second in Johannesburg last week, the best of the homegrown players. He's a fantastic record in this tournament and was joint second to Fichard in 2013. Andy Sullivan, who picked up his second win of the year in Johannesburg last week, heads up a large English contingent, while Ireland's Kevin Phelan, one of five joint runners-up last week, is also here. Louis Oosthuizen finished 27 under par when he won his second successive title in 2011, so for the second week running, whoever can score consistently well over the next 4 days could well be Grand Africa Open champion on Sunday afternoon.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Tompkins reporting from the East London Golf Club in South Africa. Finally, in pro basketball, the NBA-leading Atlanta Hawks continue to soar this season. The Hawks rallied from an 18-point deficit to defuse the visiting Houston Rockets 104-96 for their fifth straight victory and 48th win of the season. Jeff Teague scored 25 points and Al Horford added 18 points for the Hawks. James Harden, the NBA's leading scorer, was serving a one-game suspension for kicking superstar LeBron James and did not play for the Rockets, who had won their previous five games. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahayas Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, UN aid agencies in a desperate attempt to stave off a potentially large-scale cholera epidemic in Malawi. And next, one local woman who has opened her home to abused women in Sierra Leone. But first, some music. Here is Kidum of Burundi with Ambambuzi.
Om Dafer, Gango Yusufu Matuma, Yahaya Hussein. Papa Grace, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, Sisa, Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano, Todie.
Supamo Ansa Masijoro, Supama Wisera. And you watch you are mama call. Peter Wakensin, no more Samara. Peter Wakensin, Niki Ababu, Tamaro, Messi. In a cabizo, Saya, become the one. Ogasigara, we don't go, which is up. Pussy, your man, Kanura Mushin, and I get Kanura Mufasoni. Easy, see, you say. Abano, won't give up if you know. Mambuzi tavara bafuse, utera kesho titeguye. kwa grasa
Wapi maso kukuziga mitinda jawe
Hariyo kino
Mera makabano jambo mokondo razasi
Wirinde
Wirinde, wirinda vamuzi
Vamuzi, vamuzi
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Mutko abiri ya kuya
Nuse wigeru ya yata
Mutko awe ni mana
Nuse wigeru tanja toko
Umbiri sanchuti anje umukishu tangwa ni mana Babambuzi basa kwisi nakari baruse nyansu kibusa Ulivyo rero nojamu mokono razusi Nekabiso sayakwe nikute kutia kunye Kanura musinga na ye Kanura mufasoni Yisi simi nyigisi Ama nubo nima kifina Ama muzi tavara wafise Ama kera kesu titekuye Akatare tseka wakasema
Wapu maso kukuziga mitinda jawe
Kandi kabiri karatiko
Mera makabalu jambo mokondo razasi
Era hezo mgeibu za
Wirinde, wirinda wapuzi
Aho
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Imitwe, kinarira
Kidum of Burundi with Ambambuzi. UN aid agencies are increasing operations in flood-stricken Malawi in a desperate attempt to stave off a potentially large-scale cholera epidemic. The UN's Children Fund says Malawi is on high alert following a cholera outbreak in southern border areas near Mozambique. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN aid workers are alarmed at the prospect of a large nationwide outbreak of cholera in Malawi. This is because the disease is located in the southern border areas where flood victims are living in overcrowded camps, an environment in which cholera flourishes. The last time the country experienced a large-scale outbreak was in 2009, when well over 1,000 people were infected. The UN Children's Fund says it is concerned something similar might happen now, as Malawi, which was hit by devastating floods in January, is short of adequate water and sanitation. The Ministry of Health reports 39 confirmed cases of cholera, including two deaths over a two-week period. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Boulirac tells VOA, the situation is particularly alarming because all cases of cholera in Malawi are directly linked to another outbreak of the disease in neighboring Mozambique. And, he adds, the number of cases there appears to be on the increase.
Lisa, the situation is much more serious in Mozambique regarding cholera. And what is at stake now in Malawi is to respond in order to avoid propagation of cholera in Malawi. The capacity of response of health services in Malawi, the problem of access are very worrying, and all the partners are in the process to scale up their response.
The United Nations reports Mozambique has recorded more than 3,400 cholera cases and 37 deaths since December 25th, many of them children. People who become infected with cholera experience diarrhea, vomiting, and in the later stages, severe dehydration. If not properly treated, cholera can kill within hours and is especially dangerous for young children. UNICEF is providing mobile health services in Malawi in addition to safe water, sanitation, and hygiene services. All are critical in preventing the spread of cholera. Aid workers, however, are facing a problem of access to the victims because the floods have washed away bridges and roads. This could seriously hamper efforts to contain this deadly disease. The January floods are the worst on record in Malawi. The UN reports some 230,000 people still are displaced as the rains continue, and more than 170 people are missing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With schools closed for months due to the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, the country is trying to find other ways to educate children. The country has turned to daily radio and TV programs, but orphans present a particular challenge. Nina De Vries in Freetown reports on the efforts of one local woman who has opened her home to abused women who now use their skills to help teach vulnerable children.
Letter A says,
Abu.
Letter A says,
Abu.
Every day, the children, most of them orphans, are taught subjects like math and English. The resources are basic, a blackboard and no desks, just benches to sit on. But the whole point is to offer kids a better education. Anne-Marie Kalkner is the woman who opened the orphanage in her own home to help children.
I was an orphan, and I went through a lot of child abuse, gender-based violence.
Since then, she has made it her mission to help those less fortunate. Kalkner says that since Ebola struck, she has not been able to have as many children stay with her. There are about 20 orphans who live with her. The others come from single-parent homes and head back there from the orphanage at night to sleep. She says sometimes she can have up to 50 children for classes and free meals. Kalkner says it has always been harder for children to have education because many of them end up selling products on the streets.
Let us see some cats.
It is not just children that Kalkner helps. She is also bringing in young women who have faced difficult situations to teach the classes if they are qualified. Rebecca Kamara is one of those women. She's a teacher but stopped when the school shut down. Then, her mother died from Ebola in November. Kamara's landlord took advantage of that by saying she had to have sex with him if she could not afford to stay in her home.
He did this to me one because I lost my mother. Then too, he asked me to pay my house rent. At that time, I was suffering. I didn't have money to pay. Then he forced me to love him.
Kamara ran away after that with her younger brother, and Kalkner found her living on the streets and took her in. Her teaching skills have been a big benefit to the children. The orphanage does not have a radio or TV, so the children can't tune into the education classes the government has created, which airs Monday through Friday. Kamara explains that the informal classroom setting is a nice alternative for people who can't always afford radios or TVs. Kamara adds that through the teaching, she's managed to feel more confident again. Nina De Vries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing and the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After more than a year and a half working to find a path to lasting peace and economic prosperity in Africa's Great Lakes region, U.S. Special Envoy Russell Feingold is stepping down. Named to the post in July 2013, Mr. Feingold previously spent 18 years as a member of the U.S. Senate, representing the state of Wisconsin. As a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he took a great interest in African affairs, preparing him for helping deal with issues troubling the nations of Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Many of these crises remain, and the United States is committed to continuing to devote sustained, high-level attention to the Great Lakes region. Important elections will be held in Burundi and the DRC. The rebel movement, FDLR, continues to threaten Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So the stability of the Great Lakes region remains a priority of U.S. foreign policy, and a new U.S. Special Envoy will be named to continue Mr. Feingold's work. During his service, he helped lead the International Envoy's participation in the Kampala talks and their contribution to the resolution of the M23 rebellion. He helped drive the international community's renewed focus and commitment to ending the threat of the FDLR, which has produced an international and regional consensus that now is the time for the DRC and the UN peacekeeping mission to the DRC to neutralize the threat of this group. He also fostered, improved, and expanded U.S. relations with Angola, which included a trip by the Secretary of State there last May. And he launched the Great Lakes to Great Lakes Initiative, bringing together regional and international experts, academics, and government officials to discuss environmental concerns, ecoterrorism, and preservation of African Great Lakes. These and other efforts demonstrate our nation's continued commitment to stand with the people of the Great Lakes region as they work to stabilize and advance their nations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best.